Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about compliance with the Constitution and understanding this Constitution. We have to demand full compliance. Every public servant has an obligation, a legal, moral obligation, to be in full compliance to their oath of office. If they fail, we have a right, because the supreme law of the land demands that if they violate their oath, they step down and are to be removed and banned for life. So people need to know this going in, and that's the real problem. Nobody knows this, and this is why in our petition we include this to start changing paradigms, because, folks, that's how we change paradigms, by understanding what the truth is and then living by the truth. Because once we start understanding that Christ died for our sins and Christ actually lived, and we understand this being who sacrificed everything for us, now we can start living based on this new paradigm. People aren't born with that paradigm. You have to obtain that. Now, you may be born in a household that has been blessed with those blessings, and, you know, because they've already come to that knowledge. Ah, but not all households. Therefore, as we look at what the opportunities are in the world, it's getting worse and worse. As I tell people, I used to, when I meet ministers or what have you, I remember I went to a party meeting, the first party meeting, and the guy that was in charge of our district where I was residing was a minister. And he said, "Hi, I'm Minister so-and-so." And I introduced myself, and I said, "I guess we kind of look at the Constitution in the same view." And he kind of looked at me, and I go, "Well, God's plan is based on liberty, and the Constitution is the only document on the face of the earth that guarantees individual liberty and individual sovereignty. And we can't enter into the kingdom, and we can't obtain the knowledge and fulfill that knowledge if we live in a land that denies us the ability to freely exercise that." And he goes, "Oh, I never looked at it that way. Interesting." And he says, and then he says, "Okay, you know, it's kind of like Animal House at this point." He goes, "Okay, so where do you live?" "Oh, okay, so you're with this group over here." And then leaves me alone. But I want you to understand this, folks, that we're close to losing the only nation in the world that's actually willing to stand up and move people. The only reason why other nations today allow this to happen, because unfortunately, Heavenly Father, our Creator, is in charge. But He's allowing evil, because the book, good book, shows us time and time again He will allow evil to gain power over us, to basically make us miserable, to punish us, what have you. And we're seeing this today. We're living in those times. Go to Matthew 24. You want to look at what the times of the season are? That's where we're living. So my point is that if we as Christians allow the Constitution to be put aside and that global communism wins, that we will now be basically subjugated to global communism, how do you believe, you know, Christianity and the free exercise of religious worship will go? I don't think it's going to go well, because I believe that Satan will basically make everybody miserable, and I think there's going to be a lot of people that will be far more willing to die than to give up their expressions, their feelings, and their God. So that's how I see it. But let's welcome Sean back. Welcome, Sean. And don't have Tammy. Supposed to have Tammy, But Tammy had to do some really urgent things. I think she's getting a humidor for her cigars. I'm just kidding. Yeah, so that's what happens when you kind of make a joke about something. It grows legs and takes on a life of its own. Anyway, so hopefully she listens to this and gets a chuckle, because I am truly kidding. Anywho, and you know what? There's nothing wrong with a woman smoking cigars or people smoking cigars if that's what they want to do. If, you know, you choose to, you know, inhale, whatever. I mean, we all have to live with the consequences of our decisions. And I have to, you know, I have to be willing to live with mine. So good luck with yours. That's all I can say. Anywho.
I heard a saying once from a preacher. It said, yes, someone asked him if he would go to hell for smoking. And he said, no, you won't go to hell. You'll just smell like you've been there.
There you go. So do we have any go-backs for what we kind of covered? Because we covered a lot, and I know in yesterday's show, you kind of said, okay, that clarifies a lot. But I think that there was still, and there's a lot of things we can still cover if you want to, but I'm ready to go on. It's up to you.
I say we can move on. I think you covered it pretty well.
Okay. Then we shall move on. And where we left off was on, and actually I've kind of bumped us forward a little bit, because I want to start with Mr. Pinckney, and this is on Wednesday, August 29th, right? And so you have to go down a little bit of ways, because I don't have, if you notice, this is the part, and folks, you're going to notice this too, that if you go to August 29th and you click on the first name there, Mr. Williamson, that is not identified as a heading. Well, and I'm doing it right now because by doing so, then it makes it easier for you. So there's Mr. Madison, Mr. Randolph, and we keep going down, and there's Governor Morris. We keep going down. There's Mr. Dickinson. And then after Mr. Dickinson is Mr. Pinckney, and it should be highlighted in blue. Do you have that?
I do.
You do. Okay, so folks, this is on page 383, now that I've made some format changes. So it's grown a little bit. But anyway, it says, move to postpone the report in favor of, and then this thing, quotation. So go ahead. And you know, let's start with this, because this is where they start covering some things that are interesting regarding the admission of states and so forth. Go ahead.
Mr. Pinckney moved to postpone the report in favor of the following proposition. Quote, that no act of the legislature for the purpose of regulating the commerce of the United States with foreign powers or among the several states shall be passed without the assent of two-thirds of the members of each house. He remarked that there are five distinct commercial interests. One, the fisheries and West India trade, which belong to the New England states. Two, the interest of New York lay in a free trade. Three, wheat and flour, the staples of the two middle states, New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Tobacco, the staple of Maryland and Virginia and partly of North Carolina. Five, rice and indigo, the staples of South Carolina and Georgia. These different interests would be a source of oppressive regulations if no check to a bare majority should be provided. States pursue their interests with less scruple than individuals. The power of regulating commerce was a pure concession on the part of the southern states. They did not need the protection of the northern states at present.
Okay, so, and that, we kind of pointed that out. That the, even though the Articles of Confederation did require that all treaties go through Continental Congress, every state was making their own deals. And so now they were looking for this level of protection for these very specific markets. So keep going.
Mr. Martin seconded the motion. General Pinckney said it was the true interest of the southern states to have no regulation of commerce. But considering the loss brought on the commerce of the eastern states by the Revolution, their liberal conduct towards the views of South Carolina, and the interest the weak southern states had in being united with the strong eastern states, he thought it proper that no fetters should be imposed on the power of making commercial regulations, and that his constituents, though prejudiced against the eastern states, would be reconciled to this liberality. He had himself, he said, prejudice against the eastern states before he came here, but would acknowledge that he had found them as liberal and candid as any man whatever.
Okay, so you realize what they're talking about is going to address the Commerce Clause as it's starting to form. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mr. Clymer, the diversity of commercial interests of necessity creates difficulties, which ought not to be increased by unnecessary restrictions. The northern and middle states will be ruined if not enabled to defend themselves against foreign regulations. Okay. Mr. Sherman, alluding to Mr. Pinckney's enumeration of particular interest as requiring a security against abuse of the power, observed that the diversity was of itself a security, adding that to require more than a majority to decide a question was always embarrassing, as had been experienced in cases requiring the votes of 9 states in Congress.
Go ahead with the final one, and then I will...
Mr. Pinckney replied that his enumeration meant the 5-minute interests. It still left the 2 great divisions of northern and southern interests.
Ah, okay, so the... when it says minute, it means the 5 minute interests.
Ah. Yes.
Okay, so same word, it's just pronounced a little differently. But anyway, and then the 2 great differences being labor, free or bond, or bound. So what we're seeing is that they wanted to have regulations to protect the market, and or I should say commerce, that was very unique to each different section or area of the United States. And so it was being asked to actually create a regulation to keep the other states using Congress to kind of create a warfare in regulating the commerce of a state or of this state, of that state, and so forth. So in other words, as we look at the Commerce Clause in its final written or draft, you know, what was approved in the final form, there we go. Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce of the foreign trade or with foreign nations and among the states. That language is very specific, that not within the states, that among the states. So what they were looking for was that they wanted to actually, and I'll go back up to the beginning, that no act of the legislature for the purpose of regulating the commerce of the United States with foreign powers. So in other words, there was no export regulations. They couldn't put taxes on them, nor could they regulate the commerce that was coming from a state. So for the ability for the federal government to start actually creating regulations on exports and goods coming out of the United States, I think the only way that they could constitutionally create limitations is for national security. In other words, denying trade with China, denying trade back in those days with Britain. But that would affect all trade, not just specific products or markets. So the reason why I wanted to highlight this is because there was actual language seeking this level of regulation that commerce would be able to regulate commerce not only among the states but within the states as well. Because that's what this would have done. It would have opened up the door to, instead of becoming an umpire, giving them control over very specific markets. Do you see that? Even though it may not explicitly say we can go into the states, they now have the ability to define what markets they can regulate and then start building upon that. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir. And looking at it in hindsight, you can see, obviously, today with the ridiculous massive bureaucracy we have and the influence that the government has in the economy, you could see why they were concerned about these things.
Yes.
And what the end result was of eventually allowing the government to get their hands on these issues.
That's right. Because the more they can control, the more they actually can start bargaining. And basically, because as we look at this trade, remember I was saying that every state of the union was free to make their own deals with foreign nations. Well, now that the federal government can make deals, they can make deals to their advantage. Because why were states doing it? Well, because they were getting an advantage. So, and every time you put a middleman in the middle, it always causes a problem. I mean, right? You can't expect, having an extra person involved in this deal is going to make it a lot easier and cheaper. What kitchen in hell does that make sense? Because it doesn't. You get the more cooks into the pot, more cooks into the kitchen, it only adds to the confusion, it adds to the cost, it adds to the problem. It's bad. It's not what you want. You want to maintain or allow the states to maintain what they want to harvest out of their, you know, out of their resources. If it's coal to sell overseas, then it's coal to sell overseas. God forbid the state to say, you can't ship that coal, at least not under the Constitution that we have today. So let's keep going. And now we're going to kind of turn this a little bit now, because, again, this kind of starts knocking on this door, because it was brought up between the northern and southern, you know, the five minute details, and now we've got the two great issues. So it opens that door, and Governor Morris walks in. Let's go ahead.
Mr. Governor Morris opposed the object of the motion as highly injurious. Preferences to American ships will multiply them till they can carry the southern produce cheaper than it is now carried. A navy was essential to security, particularly of the southern states, and can only be had by a navigation act encouraging American bottoms and seamen. In those points of view, then, alone, it is the interest of the southern states that navigation acts should be facilitated. Shipping, he said, was the worst and most precarious kind of property and stood in need of public patronage.
He starts opening this door, so let's see Mr. Williamson of Pennsylvania talk about this.
Williamson was in favor of making two-thirds instead of a majority requisite as more satisfactory to the southern people. No useful measure, he believed, had been lost in Congress for want of 9 votes. As to the weakness of the southern states, he was not alarmed on that account. The sickliness of their climate for invaders would prevent their being made an object. He acknowledged that he did not think the motion requiring two-thirds necessary in itself, because if a majority of northern states should push their regulations too far, the southern states would build ships for themselves. But he knew the southern people were apprehensive on this subject and would be pleased with the precaution.
Okay, so because you have been reading and you kind of understand, I would say this. Now, tell me if I'm right. Reading that Mr. Williamson statement, there's no indication that he's talking about slavery at all in there. Is he?
No.
Actually, he is. When he says the sickliness of their climate for invaders, he's talking about this degree of temptation for people to come in and invade them because they cannot defend themselves. Why is that? Because of slavery.
I thought it was the humidity.
No. The sickliness of their climate for invaders. There you go. You see that? I mean, when you put it in context, all of a sudden they're talking about slavery, and you don't even know they're talking about slavery because they've already covered this so many times to say, you guys are so dependent on us doing everything that's why he even brings up the fact that if it got so bad that maybe they would start building their own ships, but they would have to bring people in just to do that one thing because they're so involved deeply within the plant, using this free labor for their riches Why get involved in really toiling for a real hard work that we can't use slaves for? They didn't want to get involved in shipping. They didn't want to get involved in manufacturing because then the few people couldn't get richer. It brought in opportunities for other people, and it made them more vulnerable.
Yeah, it might upset their oligarchy.
There you go. So it kind of helped. Yesterday I talked about, and I didn't say this, that when the vote or the election of Lincoln occurred, and Thomas Sowell talked about this, I believe it was him, that talked about, and it may have been Gutzman and or Woods, because both those guys were historians as well. There was a conversation amongst 900 plantation owners. Now, if you boil that 900 plantation owners down to families, you probably would have just a couple hundred families. Instead of saying there were 900 men that voted for the Civil War to occur, you could distill that down to there was a couple hundred families that distilled, you know, these. It was a couple hundred families that basically forced the Civil War to happen because they called for the secession of the states because they had that level of control over those, 11 states. Interesting.
Yeah.
You can't tell me that these men were, you know, these were righteous men. They were serving mammon. And they were using the blood and flesh of others to get more and more. They were so baked in this evil design of getting rich at the expense of others. Anyway. Okay, so Mr. Speight of North Carolina spoke up.
Mr. Speight was against the motion. The southern states could at any time save themselves from oppression by building ships for their own use.
Okay, Mr. Butler of South Carolina, go ahead.
Mr. Butler differed from those who considered the rejection of the motion as no concession on the part of the southern states. He considered the interests of these and of the eastern states to be as different as the interests of Russia and Turkey. Being notwithstanding desirous of conciliating the affections of the eastern states, he should vote against requiring two-thirds instead of a majority.
Okay. Colonel Mason.
If the government is to be lasting, it must be founded in the confidence and affections of the people and must be so constructed as to obtain these. The majority will be governed by their interests. The southern states are in the minority in both houses. Is it to be expected that they will deliver themselves bound hand and foot to the eastern states, enable them to exclaim, in the words of Cromwell on a certain occasion, "The Lord hath delivered them into our hands"?
Okay, so, and here's the interesting thing. They've dove into more of the argument of whether they could do it or not, whether it was something that they wanted Congress to regulate. You see my point?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're really not talking.
They're saying that they would be able to regulate and do these things by two-thirds.
Or by just a majority. By just a majority, be able to regulate commerce.
They're arguing over whether it should be two-thirds or a majority.
Right. Okay, so Mr. Mason makes his comment. Now, Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Wilson took notice of the several objections and remarked that if every peculiar interest was to be secured, unanimity ought to be required. The majority, he said, would be no more governed by interests than the minority. It was surely better to let the latter be bound hand and foot than the former. Great inconveniences had, he contended, been experienced in Congress from the Article of Confederation requiring 9 votes in a certain case.
Okay, so sadly, we got interrupted, so we'll try to do that again. My bad. we'll be right back after this short promo, and then Madison will speak after Mr. Wilson.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so Sean, I apologize that we were so rudely interrupted. I wasn't even looking at the timer. But let me just say this, because my promo kind of prodded my mind on bringing this point up. So when you talk to people about this great deal of fixing all of our problems, I offer up a flow chart that shows you how we will effectively get the federal government into full compliance once we get the states into full compliance. That can only happen by taking back our counties. Therefore, I offer up a flowchart that shows you how this will happen, that we will actually get rid of all of these government bodies that are literally waging warfare against us, doing nothing good at all. Yeah, they may be providing welfare for businesses such as agriculture or what have you. That's all got to stop. This is what would restore family farming again and get rid of corporate farming so that we don't have and are using our food fields for fuel. I could go on and on. But the point is, challenge anybody that says this is the way. Show me. I want to see a flow chart how this is going to actually take the, you know, all of these unconstitutional powers that the government has gained and are looking to gain more. How is this going to solve that problem by me, you know, not having to pay taxes? Well, at least you don't pay taxes. See my point? It's the same thing with the Convention of States. It's the same thing with these nullification people. It's the same thing even with the party, because they don't have a process. They don't care. The party and the courts are the two primary mechanisms of resistance. And until we basically take them over or abandon them, courts we need to abandon, we need to take the party over, and we make the party about the Constitution, then we become a one-party system again. Just like with Madison and Jefferson and that one-party Republican Party that was limited, they were basically the Constitution Party. But there's no such thing as a constitutional form of government other than the Republican form of government, because that's what it really was under the Constitution. So this is why I say constitutional law is contrived. The lawyers created this, you know, it's like Verizon law. Oh, well, hey, I know Verizon law. Well, what does that mean? I know contract law. It's just this fancy way of saying I understand contract law. Because constitutional law is contract law. Verizon law is contract law. If there's a contract out there, you could make a law after it. Because of those things that are enumerated within that contract would be all considered under that Verizon law. And so if this helps you all of a sudden see this in a different light, then that's great. But the fact of the matter is, challenge people. If they can't give you a flow chart, just trust me, then run. Run and start putting your head in the books and start reading these founding documents that we're giving you. This will lead you to the truth. And the truth is not mine. The truth is his. And the truth came from Madison. It came from these men, not from me. I'm just the vehicle giving it to you. Anywho, let's move on. You were just now covering, unfortunately, Mr. Wilson And so if you wouldn't mind just rereading this again, because you got cut off, I apologize.
Mr. Wilson took notice of the several objections and remarked that if every peculiar interest was to be secured, unanimity ought to be required. The majority, he said, would be no more governed by interest than the minority. It was surely better to let the latter be bound hand and foot than the former. Great inconveniences had, he contended, been experienced in Congress from the Article of Confederation requiring 9 votes in certain cases.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people gloss over that, but if you go back and look at the source documents of the journals or whatever you want to call it of Congress at that time, mm-hmm. under Articles of Confederation, because I had gone and checked it out one time, and they were desperate. They could not get anything done. The country was in peril, and we were in war, and they were just doing things off the cuff. They were just doing what they had to do to survive, and it was coming to an end.
Yep.
And like you've said before, that was the reason, the impetus for this convention.
Yep. Yes. Because of their ineptness and impotence, it was the impetus.
The impotence.
No. Their ineptness, because of their ineptness and their impotence, they were forced into the impetus to...
Oh, yes.
Okay. I'm just tying all three words there for you, buddy. That would confuse most people right there. Huh? What did you say?
It was an impediment.
Okay. All right. So enough. I do have a lot of fun doing this, but anyway. It's not so much fun when you do it all by yourself, just talking and reading. So anyway, let's get to Mr. Madison, though. Let's see what little nuggets he wants to add to this, because it's a good paragraph. Let's go.
Mr. Madison went into a pretty full view of the subject. He observed that the disadvantage to the southern states from a navigation act lay chiefly in a temporary rise of freight, attended, however, with an increase of southern as well as northern shipping. With the immigration of northern seamen and merchants to the southern states, and with the removal of the existing and injurious retaliations among the states on each other, the power of foreign nations to obstruct our retaliating measures on them by corrupt influence would also be less if a majority should be made competent than if 2/3 of each house should be required to legislative acts in this case. Mm-hmm. An abuse of the power would be qualified with all these good effects. But he thought an abuse was rendered improbable by the provision of 2 branches, by the independence of the Senate, by the negative of the executive, by the interests of Connecticut and New Jersey, which were agricultural, not commercial states, by the interior interests, which was also agricultural in the most commercial states. By the accession of Western states, which would be altogether agricultural. He added that the Southern states would derive an essential advantage in the general security afforded by the increase of our maritime strength. He stated that the vulnerable situation of them all, and of Virginia in particular. The increase of the coasting trade and of seamen would also be favorable to the Southern states by increasing the consumption of their produce. If the wealth of the Eastern should in a still greater proportion be augmented, that wealth would contribute the more to the public wants and be otherwise a national benefit.
Okay, so he's kind of looking at the big picture of how this is all kind of going down this path of, just let this occur. Don't create super forces or create a requirement that requires a super force. Because that's where all of a sudden corruption starts coming in. Hey, what's it going to take to get you to vote our way? Anyway, right. Mr. Rutledge, go ahead.
Mr. Rutledge was against the motion of his colleague. It did not follow from a grant of the power to regulate trade that it would be abused. At the worst, a Navigation Act could bear hard a little while only on the southern states. As we are laying the foundation for a great empire, we ought to take a permanent view of the subject and not look at the present moment only. He reminded the House of the necessity of securing the West India trade to this country. That was the great object, and a Navigation Act was necessary for obtaining it.
Okay, so now he's kind of giving them this this view of maybe we're creating an empire. So what is it we really want to do? Where is the strength going to be? Because all indications are they wanted the strength to be in the state government. But right here, they're playing this little Russian roulette with the idea of regulating individual states and their commerce. Not within the states, but at least regulating their commerce that's coming out of the state. So Mr. Randolph then adds this.
Mr. Randolph said that there were features so odious in the Constitution as it now stands that he doubted whether he should be able to agree to it. A rejection of the motion would complete the deformity of the system. He took notice of the argument in favor of giving the power of a trade to a majority, drawn from the opportunity foreign powers would have of obstructing retaliating measures, if two-thirds were made requisite. He did not think there was weight in that consideration. The difference between a majority and two-thirds did not afford room for such an opportunity. Foreign influence would also be more likely to be exerted on the president, who could require three-fourths by his negative. He did not mean, however, to enter into the merits. What he had in view was merely to pay the way for a declaration which he might be hereafter obliged to make if an accumulation of obnoxious ingredients should take place, that he could not give his assent to the plan.
Okay. Mr. Gorham.
Mr. Gorham, if the government is to be so fettered as to be unable to relieve the eastern states, what motive can they have to join in it, and thereby tie their own hands for measures which they could otherwise take for themselves? The eastern states were not led to strengthen the Union by fear for their own safety. He deprecated the consequences of disunion, but if it should take place, it was the southern part of the continent that had the most reason to dread them. He urged the improbability of a combination against the interest of the southern states, the different situation to the northern middle states being a security against it. It was moreover certain that foreign ships would never be altogether excluded, especially those of nations in treaty with us.
Okay.
On the question to postpone in order to take up Mr. Pinckney's motion.
And it failed. And so the report of the committee for striking out Section 6 requiring two-thirds of each house to pass a Navigation Act was then agreed without contest. So, in other words, the idea of requiring two-thirds of the House to create one, a Navigation Act or some kind of protection over these very specific markets of commerce that were identified as specific to very specific states. Okay, so Mr. Butler then basically says
Mr. Butler moved to insert after Article 15, if any person bound to service or labor in any of the United States shall escape into another state, he or she shall not be discharged from such service or labor in consequence of any regulations subsisting in the state to which they escape, but shall be delivered up to the person justly claiming their service or labor, which was agreed to without
contest. Right. Contest. No, everybody just agreed. No contest. All right. So that right there was the in the Article 4, where it basically says any slaves that run away to another state where there's no slavery, you still have to deliver that slave back up. Right? So that's what that was right there.
Yeah, Band-Aid.
Okay. This is an interesting one. And this is why I kind of start this off with, how's it so? Anyway, this is talking about admissions of states coming into the Union. So let's start with Mr. Governor Morris.
Mr. Governor Morris moved to strike out the last two sentences to wit, quote, if the admission be consented to, the new states shall be admitted on the same terms with the original states, but the legislature may make conditions with the new states concerning the public debt which shall be then subsisting. He did not wish to bind down the legislature to admit Western states on the terms here stated.
Okay, Mr. Madison.
Mr. Madison opposed the motion, insisting that the Western states neither would nor ought to submit to a union which degraded them from an equal rank with other states.
Okay. Mr.
Colonel Mason, mm-hmm. If it were possible by just means to prevent immigrations to the Western country, it might be good policy. But go the people will as they find it for their interest. Go the people will if they find it for their interest. And the best policy is to treat them with that equality which will make them friends, not enemies.
Okay.
Mr. Governor Morris did not mean to discourage the growth of a Western country. He knew that to be impossible. He did not wish, however, to throw the power into their hands.
Okay.
Mr. Sherman was against the motion and for fixing an equality of privileges by the Constitution.
Okay.
Mr. Langdon was in favor of the motion. He did not know but circumstances might arise which would render it inconvenient to admit new states on terms of equality. Mr. Williamson was for leaving the legislature free. The existing small states enjoy an equality now, and for that reason are admitted to it in the Senate. The reason is not applicable to new Western states. On Mr. Governor Morris's motion for striking out, we have New Hampshire, aye, Massachusetts, aye, Connecticut, aye, New Jersey, aye, Pennsylvania, aye, Delaware, aye, Maryland, no, Virginia, no, North Carolina, aye, South Carolina, aye, and Georgia, aye.
Okay, so it carried. So it passed. So they struck it out. Okay. Now, Mr. Martin and Mr. Morris then move forward.
They moved to strike out of Article 17, quote, but to such admission, the consent of two-thirds of the members present shall be necessary before any question was taken on this motion. Mr. Governor Morris moved the following proposition as a substitute for the 17th article. Quote, new states may be admitted by the legislature into this union, but no new state shall be erected within the limits of any of the present states without the consent of the legislature of such state, as well as of the general legislature. The first part to union inclusive was agreed to without contest.
Okay. So, Mr. Martin, then?
And doesn't that give you an idea, or is that an indication of the states creating their own governments and creating their own sovereignty as a state?
Well, so they're looking at a state as existing, right?
Right, but I'm saying where it says that no new state can be part of another state.
Okay, but this line is very specific. It says that no new state shall be erected within the limits of any of the present states without the consent of the legislature of such state.
Right.
As well as Congress. So this is very specific. It's not saying a territory and the process of how a territory becomes a state. Okay.
I agree.
Okay.
I was just trying to get to clear it up in my mind, because what happens if a faction of people in a certain part of a state, like they're arguing over maybe the state's got a coastline and they also have an interior, so the people in this part of the state don't like what the government's doing, so they just say, well, we're going to make our own state, but it's already a state, so they can't do that.
Okay, so what happened with West Virginia?
I'm not sure. I don't really know the...
So West Virginia became a state during the Civil War, because West Virginia didn't want to secede.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Virginia, this actually helps everybody understand that Virginia did secede. They weren't in the Union. And because of that, Congress already allowed at that point, before the Civil War was over and before Lincoln, you know, could, you know, come up with some stupid tyrannical law, at that point Congress admitted West Virginia into the Union because Virginia was no longer a part of it.
So were they part of the, so were they excluded from the Reconstruction Acts because of that?
So West Virginia.
That was the first thing that popped in my head when they, the government took over the states, even states that had already applied to get back in the union or whatever the process was. They didn't like what they were doing, so they came in and separated into military districts. Yeah. Was West Virginia exempt from that?
Okay, so let me show you statehood order. So West Virginia, let me find it. West Virginia became a state in the 1863. In other words, 2 years after the war had begun and after Virginia had seceded. At that point, West Virginia did not want to fight and defend the Confederation or the Confederacy.
Yeah.
And so they asked to join the Union. And so at that point, I'm not sure if Lincoln, you know, unconstitutionally allowed it to happen, or whether they, he just had Congress, you know, come in and admit West Virginia. It might have actually been at that same time where they were doing the 13th Amendment to say, hey, I want you to come in and do an amendment and admit West Virginia into the Union. So that's how West Virginia got in, though. And they were actually a part of Virginia. And so it's been a contention that they should never have been able to, allowed to leave because the Constitution did allow them. But actually, at that point, they were not in the Union, which is why and how West Virginia exists today. So when somebody says, oh, well, they couldn't leave the Union, actually they did, because Virginia didn't grant West Virginia statehood by the Constitution. So the Constitution was not applicable because they were out of it.
Right.
Okay. Not that I'm trying to confuse the matter. I'm just trying to help shine a little light on, you know, here's some evidence for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, okay. I mean, that just shows that that faction of people within West Virginia disagreed with it and how that fell.
Right.
Because, like I was saying, when I was reading, getting some background on the issues we were talking about last time, I saw that they had divided the Confederacy up into military administrative districts. And I was wondering when exactly West Virginia got out and how that ended up happening. But no, the information I have says they were not part of the Reconstruction. They were exempt from that because they came in 1863 as a separate state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so as we look at what Mr. Martin said.
Mr. Martin
opposed
the latter part, noting he said, nothing, he said, would so alarm the limited states as to make the consent of the large states claiming the western lands necessary to the establishment of new states within their limits. It is proposed to guarantee the states, Vermont shall be reduced by force in favor of the states claiming it. Franklin and the western county of Virginia were in a like situation.
Right.
On Mr. Governor Morris's motion to substitute, et cetera, it was agreed to.
Actually, it wasn't agreed to. I think there's only six. Yay, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, 6-5. It actually did pass. My bad.
Right.
I saw so many no's start.
I was just reading what it said. I have no idea whether it did or not.
Okay, so Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Sherman was against it. He thought it unnecessary. The Union cannot dismember a state without its consent. Mr. Langdon thought there was great weight in the argument of Mr. Luther Martin and that the proposition substituted by Mr. Governor Morris would excite a dangerous opposition to the plan. Mr. Governor Morris thought, on the contrary, that the small states would be pleased with the regulation, as it holds up the idea of dismembering the large states.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Butler, if new states were to be erected without the consent of the dismembered states, nothing but confusion would ensue. Whenever taxes should press on the people, demagogues would set up their schemes of new states.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Johnson agreed in general with the ideas of Mr. Sherman, but was afraid that as the clause stood, Vermont would be subjected to New York, contrary to the faith pledged by Congress.
Okay.
He was of opinion that Vermont ought to be compelled to come into the Union.
Okay.
Mr. Langdon said his objections were connected with the case of Vermont. If they are not taken in and remain exempt from taxes, it would prove of great injury to New Hampshire and other neighboring states.
Okay.
Mr. Dickinson hoped the article would not be agreed to. He dwelt on the impropriety of requiring the small states to secure the large ones and their extensive claims of territory. Mr. Wilson, when the majority of a state wish to divide, they can do so. The aim of those in opposition to the article, he perceived, was that the general government should abet the minority, and by that means divide a state against its own consent.
Okay.
Mr. Governor Morris, if the forced division of the states is the object of the new system and is to be pointed against one or two states, he expected the gentlemen from those would pretty quickly leave us.
Okay.
And then they adjourned.
Okay. Now let's stop right here. We got a minute. This begs, because I talk about very specific constitutional amendments. Admitting new states into the Union, Article 4, Section 3, needs to change. And I say this because the way corruption occurs is when the power is baked so long into an entity that there's just no way a state's going to divide itself. Therefore, I believe that the rule of thumb and maybe the protection should be that any state that has existed in the Union, that has existed in the Union for over a century, meaning almost all of the states except for Hawaii and Alaska, would then be able to subdivide as necessary, as long as the territory of that state is not fully contained within the state. In other words, you can't take the center of the state and make a state out of it. You have to have a border with another state and or, you know, a coastline, you know, a boundary river, you know, border river, what have you. So in other words, this state needs to be one not within the center. The state needs to be over 100 years, and the new state has to be able to sustain itself. In other words, it can't be so small that, you know, a county can break away and actually function as a state. Does that make sense? Now, a county can, if it can sustain itself, because that's the catch right there. So think about this, because why is this important? And I'm going to really drop this. As new states start joining the Union from the world, then this will actually allow Indiana, Illinois, California, Washington, Oregon, some of these old states that have plenty of territory, to actually create sustaining states, to actually basically create 100 more states easily out of the United States, to where we have 150 states. How many nations in the world are there? About 200, and many of them may become states in the Union, and we can talk about this in our next episode of why. So before we go forward, why would we want to consider this for security purposes? I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.